You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Two-thirds of the Earth is covered by water. The other third is covered by Jerry Durant. And he's in constant motion. I've pinned him down for about 60 minutes in between movements. So, first of all, sir, good to hear your voice. Thanks for coming on.
Good to hear yours again, Mike. I'll just keep him busy.
No, let me tell you, there's no dust gathering on you.
That's true.
We first met in 2004 when you came over to be the head of the Iraqi Security Force.
Now, back up.
We met before that?
I got a call from Dunford the first week of May asking me to come over for a three-week TAD trip because we had a break in the CACS program. So I was Coyote 6. I went over there on a three-week TAD and ended up spending 8.5 months and then went home with 2 Purple Hearts. So I didn't come over to take over the Iraqi.
You know what? Your personal issues and how naive you are, That's not our concern here.
No.
Right? I think I remember sitting around the table at one point thinking, hearing something to the effect of, just get him over here. We'll deal with the rest of it later. So I don't know who told you.
I didn't know that.
I don't know who told you.
Now the truth comes out.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. We're going to have a guy with that kind of experience come over here, kind of look at it for a couple weeks, and then we're going to let him go home. That's probably not going to happen.
I'm pretty naive, I guess.
You are. I have some land in some swampland in Florida if you're looking for a good deal.
That's pretty funny.
We crossed paths, and then you became the adult in the room, and is it those connections and the work that you did there that translated into the work you're doing now? Because you were a huge part of trying to, at least out west, trying to get our hands around what did we even need to do? Who do we do it with?
Yeah.
What, I mean, it was groping in the dark because we simply didn't know what we were doing. Talk about what you did then and how has that translated into what you're doing now?
Well, in 36 years in the Marine Corps, Vietnam, last corporal, sergeant, got out and got commissioned. I've worked all over the world. I've enjoyed working with Marines and indigenous populations. I get along with almost everybody. I got to Iraq, and the problem we had was people hadn't been reading the history about how the Iraqi army was run under Saddam. I understood that, from the get-go, and I tried to work with the Iraqis. Never promised them anything, and then I got along real well with the people who are trying to kill us. And that's, I'm doing now. I'm working in Iraq right now. About 5 years ago when ISIS threatened Baghdad, probably 75 or 80% of the embassy was evacuated. I flew into Baghdad. And everybody told me I was going the wrong direction. That's one reason we get along real well with the Iraqi MOD. And we didn't abandon the place.
The
stuff I've done in the past has really helped.
Tell everybody what you're doing now, and then we'll talk about it a little bit. What are you doing now? This is always interesting.
In 2012, we actually built a National Defense University, Iraqi War College, for the Iraqi MOD in Baghdad, right across the street from the American Embassy. And then about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, I found out they had a language school, DLI Baghdad, that belonged to the school. So I went out in town and brought that on campus, designed and built a language lab for them. And it's world class. It's probably better than the one in San Antonio or any place you go. But did a really good job doing that. But we've been doing the English language. We're actually got a class going now teaching 7 different languages. And then the Iraqi Special Forces found out, or they saw what I did there. And my latest trip, we got a construction project going for the Iraqi Special Forces, building them a language school, or upgrading what they've got already. They're working on language labs right now. and it's going over really well.
So explain the requirement to for so many different languages. Why do they need to speak seven different languages? Take us around the wagon wheel. What languages and why?
Well, of course, English, of course, is the biggest one because English is the international language. But we're also teaching Russian. And a lot of times, you know, it's like five or six or seven students because the Iraqis are going to school, you know, all over Europe. We're teaching Russian, English, Kurdish, Turkish, Italian, German, and Persian. I think those are the five or six or seven. But they've got the capability of, you know, bringing instructors in if there's an odd language you need taught. But, you know, they're not just totally dependent on the U.S. for these schools. That's why they're running all these different languages. You know, a lot of their pilots go to France for pilot training, or they go to Italy for pilot training, that kind of stuff.
All right. Now I'm beginning to understand. Tell us about Iraq a little bit. You know, we've had you come and go, and the last we talked, somewhat surprising to me, I will tell you.
January 21st is National Hugging.
More and more Iraqis believe. Now, this is before the fall of Mosul, but how more and more Iraqis believed that the only way that they would move forward was somehow or other partitioning the country and moving forward as some kind of federal republic. Has that changed since the fall of Mosul?
No.
And no. Really?
There's, you know, the guys, you know, and again, this is, you know, some people I've talked to and I've known for a while. They're still talking, you know, the sectarian violence over there continues, and no one sees it letting up. I can't remember if I told you this or not, but I just came back less than a week ago. But when I was in January, I talked to one of my Iraqi counterparts or friends, and he was asking me, you know, just had a candid conversation about his future in Iraq, and he wanted to know what I thought about what his future would be. And I was trying to be polite, you know, being politically correct or whatever.
Right.
And when I told him, you know, just, you know, the country, you know, has got a chance to come together and do this and that. And when I was done, he said, you know, I completely disagree with you. I have no future in Iraq. And then about 3 or 4 days later, I met with another guy, and he asked me the same question, and they told me the same thing when I was finished. So the guys I'm working with don't see a future for themselves in Iraq.
Now, are they
the split government?
Okay, are they Sunni? Are they Shiite? Or
yes?
Yes, what?
Both.
Both are Sunni.
Both. No, I had a Shia and a Sunni doing the same thing.
Really, I would
and
think
the Sunnis, especially because the Sunnis right. are completely disenfranchised over there. They're almost all. I mean, there's not a whole lot left in the military as far as the leadership. They've gotten rid of most of them, and then the Shias. You know, they're very happy that we invaded the place, but you know, the violence continues. I've got two doctors on our staff over there, and their number one medical concern is high blood pressure. Because when these guys come to work, they can't wear a uniform to and from work. They'll get fascinated at some point. They don't know if their families are going to make it, you know, to and from school or to and from the market. It's not a good situation for them.
How has the fall of Mosul and ISIS being pretty much contained in the region, how has that affected things, Jerry?
Well, the prime minister, when Mosul fell, made an announcement that, you know, that defeated ISIS, big mistake. Right after that, probably the same day, the bombs started going off in Baghdad. So, you know, they might have kicked them out of Mosul, but they were still around the country. I get intel updates every day, and there's, you know, 5 or 6 incidents around the country where they're arresting people or shooting people or bombs going off. So they might have taken care of, you know, the big mob, but the ISIS is still there.
So what we knew after, for instance, after the surge and after all that got cooled down, they seeped back into the woods, if you will,
yeah.
And then came out. So then they reared their head again in terms of attempting to create the physical caliphate. and now they've been ejected out of that. So it's seeping back into the woods again, and we'll see more of the car bombings, the assassinations, the occasional ambushes where you kill large numbers and aren't paying attention, targets of opportunity. So we'll see that version again.
You know, they're knocking off police checkpoints. They're, you know, ambushing Iraqi military if they catch, you know, four and five in a group. It's not a safe place.
All right. So so now are you predominantly, when you go, are you predominantly in Baghdad, or now that you're,
well, right now, yes.
All right. All right. So
you know, when I was there a year ago, I did 7 site surveys for the embassy. So I actually had Shia bodyguard, Shia militia bodyguard, because we went out to the Syrian border and went all the way north, all the way south, and then out west, looking at language training facilities for the U.S. government. Right now, my contacts and or the stuff we're doing is right there in the green zone of Baghdad.
Okay, and now so tell us, how has Baghdad changed? Is Baghdad a safe place? It's not a safe place, or because, you know, from what you say about high blood pressure and not being able to wear a uniform, it doesn't sound like Baghdad's changed a whole lot from you know, the just the instability and the violence that has been going on there for years.
Well, when I was there in January, we've got about 300 local workforce on a construction project, and I had 5 of them killed in January. It was night, two suicide bombs went off, killed, I think it was like 35 or 36, and wounded about 120. And those guys, the 5 that we had killed, were just on their way to work. So, and then the guys just came back less than a week ago, and that was another bomb went off down there in Baghdad, and there were probably a dozen killed on that one.
You spend a lot of time there. That's that's kind of your home away from home, if you will. Congratulations. Is it getting better? Is it getting in any way, shape, or form better?
A little bit. I mean, it's slowed down some, but like I said, every day you never know, you know, where a bomb's going to go off. That's the problem. That's what with the high blood pressure. You know, these people worry every time they go to and from work.
Right.
And so they can't wear a uniform. So they do, they can't get assassinated.
Okay, so help us with the crystal ball. We have, as a nation, we have gone over and we've tipped over a government. We've now created the conditions on the ground that are ripe for the Iranians to reestablish the Persian Empire. So it's with the president saying, yeah, we're out of Syria too. Like, what? And then the looming war between Israel and Iran, which seems to be a very real thing, which the Israelis will not hesitate to get after because they know they have to do it. From your conversations, I've read that the Iraqis do not want to be dominated by the Iranians.
That's pretty much true. If I talk to them, that's what they're talking about. You know, in January we had a bunch of Iranians. No, I guess I'm losing track of the trip. Last year, late, you know, before Mosul fell, the compound we built actually had a bunch of Iranians in it, and then they're not there now. And you start talking to the Iraqis, they don't want to be dominated by Iran. And one thing we're doing with the language schools, we're teaching, we're getting probably 100 and some people every year going through, or every 6 months going through language training. And that has a counter impact on the Iranian influence, because these guys are learning English or interacting with Americans, and they're coming to school here in the United States. So the U.S. government's happy with what we're doing. I know SecDef is interested, because it does help counter the Iranian influence, you know, teaching these guys to speak English. And there's a few that are learning Persian, but not that many.
So you think if the Iraqis are left to their own, what becomes of them? Do they become a secular nation? Will they be Shiite-dominated? If you could...
Shiite-dominated.
Shiite-dominated.
They are right now.
What is, and then what will there be? What will their relationship be to Iran? Because you know, because that is, that's the huge question, right? And even now, I mean, we ramped up our support, our advisor support, our air support to eject ISIS out. What does that mean for the United States? Does it mean that we've just delivered Iraq to Iran? Okay, we got the Sunni warriors out of here. Here you go. What does it mean for the future, Jerry?
Well, one thing is, you know, the only Iraqi military unit that we've been successful with is the counterterrorism service, the CTS.
Right.
And that's no longer part of MOD. It's its own ministry. And the reason they've been so successful, I think they were created in late 2003 or sometime in 2004. There's been special force advisors for those guys 24/7 since that time. And it's just not, you know, it's U.S., it's Danish, it's, I think Belgium's been in there. Whoever's been involved in Iraq has had special forces, and they're still there, and they've been a very successful unit. And there's Shias, there's Sunnis, there's some Kurds in there, and there's, you know, Christians, Muslims, everything. It's a big mix. And, you know, we work with the Iraqi army, and it's been unsuccessful because we haven't had advisors with them full time. And a lot of the time, you'll send advisors over, and they'll do their 6-month tour and go home, and a new guy comes in with better ideas. So if we're going to be successful, we need to have advisors there on the ground with the Iraqi army full time. And they're not doing that right now.
Because it looks like the advisors are full time. If we do the Iraqis want that? Is that something that they would like?
They do. Yeah, they do now. You know, when we first started this contract, I was actually hired to be the mentor for an Iraqi lieutenant general that ran the school, and that, you know, that my mentorship with him lasted about the first 10 minutes. Because back then, you know, in 2012, they couldn't be seen working with an American or talking to an American. And that's since changed. They understand the importance of having the U.S. in there. And they're actually trying to just come in and do more mentorship and then, you know, get BTCs going with the War College in Carlisle and that kind of stuff. Because they want to work with the Americans now.
Explain what BTCs are.
Video teleconferencing. Okay. So they want one school to work with the, you know, their counterpart school in the U.S. You know, just trade, you know, get on the VTC and talk back and forth.
Got it. The talk about the growing Iranian presence in Syria. Do you, from the people that you meet in Baghdad, do you get any sense of that growing shitstorm that is on the horizon?
A little bit. We didn't really talk that much about it. You know, they're aware of it. They're not happy with it. There's nothing they can do about it. You know, the Iraqis I'm talking to, and I've gotten some pretty good ones, said, you know, the U.S. was ahead of the game about 5 years ago in Syria, and then they started backing out, and now, because the Russians didn't have the influence, Assad was not real popular, and, we blew it in Syria, and now the Russians, are more powerful than we are, or more influential.
I've had people ask me this question, and I don't know the answer, so I'll ask you. Bashar al-Assad he's of the Alawite tribe. They are a minority. The majority of the population is Sunni. Can there be, if there's any kind of Sunni leader that becomes the head of a government in Syria, that means Iran is leaving and Russia's not too far behind. So that can't happen, can it?
Well, take a look at Iraq before we invaded the place. You know, Saddam Hussein was Sunni, and they were the minority, and they were in charge, and they were the military, and they had all the power.
Right.
It's the same thing with Assad in Syria. You know, they can't get him out right now because, you know, he's been in charge and he's got the military behind him. And his military leadership, I guarantee, are all his own tribe.
Right.
So I don't see anyone replacing him.
It's the mirror image. So when you talk regime change in Syria, the discussion can't go very far, because unless you're willing, unless the Sunni majority is accepting, ready to accept another Alawite that it somehow wants to form some kind of coalition or joint government. But when you're talking about, you know, the demographics of Syria, they don't lean towards Iran and Russia. They lean towards the Sunnis. And so it's interesting. The other question: what do they say about the Kurds? We're in this five-way fight over the Kurds. The Turks want to kill them. The Iraqis want them to go back up there and shut up. They have been our steadiest ally in the region, and we're in this position where our NATO ally wants to kill them. The people that we just helped eject ISIS from you know much of the north western and the western part of Iraq, they're not real pleased with them. What happens to the Kurds in that shit sandwich?
Well, one thing, you're back up just a second.
Sure.
The Kurds, right, I was over there for like 2006 and 2007 with 9 Corps. I had Kurds and Shias and Sunnis and Christians working for me. And, you know, talking to these guys about the situation up there, and I spent quite a bit of time on Kurdistan. The Kurds have been treated like second class citizens, for years and years and years. You know, so under Saddam, one of the guys that worked for me, his dad is a retired army colonel. He was forcibly moved up to Tikrit by Saddam, trying to push the Kurds out and get more Sunnis up there. They've been treated worse than the blacks were back in the 50s and the 60s.
So they've been segregated and pushed to that northern region of the country in an effort to eliminate them.
To eliminate and take over, you know, put more Shias, the Sunnis, excuse me. But the Sunnis I was talking to, they were forcefully moved up there by Saddam when they retired. He did that with thousands of people. Thousands of military people.
So what happens to them? Because they have been the steadiest, both on both sides of the border. They have been our steadiest partner. And now all of a sudden, do we do, you know, to them what we did to the Montenegro guards in Vietnam? Just walk away and say, hey, sorry, you know?
I don't think we'll do that. I think we'll continue to support the guys. They need the support. And the U.S. has been backing them since time of Saddam.
Right.
I don't think we'll walk off and leave them.
Well, since before Saddam. Well, I mean, and that was the whole, the Northern Fly Zone and all the refugees up there. That was all the Kurdish part of the country, yes?
Yeah, that went back to Saddam Gas and
right.
Kurds.
Right.
But that's when we did start doing the no-fly zone.
Right. Now, it's just, what a mess. Give me your thoughts on, do you have any Israeli friends? What do they tell you? Cause they're ready.
I don't have any.
we've seen them,
but traveling too much.
they are not afraid. I mean, they waited for that drone that the Syrians were flying, to get into Israeli airspace. And then they launched their, then they began to service their target list that they update every day. And they just used it as a pretense. As somebody who's not no stranger to the region, how do you avoid a war between Iran and Iran? What, just like last weekend, their head of the army said, we will annihilate Israel within 25 years.
That's not going to happen. I mean, they got the U.S. back in them. I think they'll do what they did. What year was it? Was it they went in and bombed the nuclear facilities
in Iraq and Syria? Yeah, they did. Well, they've done it to both Iraq and Syria when they started to go down that path.
So eventually, something like that's going to happen. The Israelis aren't going to sit back and wait for the big bomb to hit them.
Is there any doubt in your mind that the Israelis will do that?
Oh no, it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when. I think the U.S. is going to back them because they have to.
Yeah, we have to. I mean, what else are we going to do? We're going to sit there with wringing our hands? You know, let me ask you this, Jerry. You've been around for a while. First of all, what year did you go to Vietnam?
So I enlisted in 69. I was in Vietnam 70, 71 with India. Well, HMS 31 attached to India Company 31.
All right. So, And what part of Vietnam were you in?
We were we were in I Corps. We were the kind of headquarters was just north of Da Nang, and we had from Da Nang up to Hai Van Pass and back interior Fort Caisson.
Okay, let me just tell you. Will you be impressed if I tell you that I know where Hai Van Pass is?
Yeah. It's a pretty prominent landmark if you try to look at the map.
The but
pretty rugged terrain.
Wow. The no, you know what? One of the things I've got a huge education about is Vietnam. Just the different interviews that I've done over the course of almost 2 years now, and you know, Vietnam, depending on what year you were there and where you were, completely different experiences.
I'm glad you're saying that.
Wow. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, I've you know, guys who were in Northern I Corps had a completely different experience than guys who were, you know, on the coastal plain near Da Nang, you know, fighting, hooking and jabbing with the Viet Cong. And it was a completely different experience after 1968 in the coastal plain as opposed to pre-Tet. It's just amazing. You've watched all that. When you look at American use of our power, it's like, are we having to relearn the lessons that the only way you can guarantee peace is through strength? Because if you watch the Chinese in the South China Sea and held just this last week in conducted live fire exercises with an aircraft carrier for the first time in the East China Sea, circling Taiwan and saying, watch your step. I mean, are we having to learn that the only way that you can really guarantee peace is through strength and not through wishy-washy policy and vacillating defenses and things like that? Are we relearning
you gotta,
that?
You've got to be strong. Yeah, we're relearning. And I think under Trump, people are understanding that because Trump will step in and do what he has to do to keep us on top.
Interesting. What he made a trip to Riyadh not long after he was inaugurated, and he spoke to much of the Arab world. And we say Arab,
did he bow to the king?
I can't remember. Did he? I don't think he did.
No, he didn't.
The that was a big deal.
Obama did.
And they hated him. He bowed to the king, and then he rolled over for the Iranians, and they absolutely loathed him. I'm curious. What happens relative to American power in the region? And there's a change in Saudi Arabia that is a bit head scratching. It's like, holy smoke, is that guy, young guy, actually going to be able to do what he said he's going to do, which is trying to create a more modern Arab state, a more open Arab state? What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's moving in the right direction. I think he's going to succeed because he's got the WASTA, he's got the power behind him. And, you know, and the people I've talked to in Iraq and then Jordan are very happy with what the guy's doing. They see it as a positive change. It'll impact them too. Not so much in Jordan, because Jordan's pretty modern already.
Right, Jordan.
Getting back to your comments about Vietnam, you're spot on with, I mean, depending where you're at, when you were there, it was a completely different war. I mean, you'd be there the same year, but depending where you're at in the country, it was a completely different war.
Well, you know, one of the ways I learned it was talking. I was talking to, he just passed away yesterday, Ken Pipes, and he asked me, Mac, do you know anything about My Lai? And I was kind of embarrassed. I said, well, I know kind of the basics, but I was kind of I was kind of bullshitting, so I wouldn't be embarrassed. And then I started reading about it, and it was completely different than I thought. And then what I did was I invited guys who were leaders in Vietnam, squad leaders, platoon commanders, company commanders, opsos, whatever, to bring them on to talk about their Vietnam experience. Was rape and killing civilians, was that just a part of it? because that's the legend of it, that's just what they did in Vietnam. And it was interesting, Jerry. Every one of those guys said, no, that's not, is that what we did? And Carl Marlana said, look, how do you rape somebody when you're on patrol? He said, look, you know, my experience, you know, he said, and I was up in the Central Highlands, but when you're hooking and jabbing in bad guy country, how do you even get that in your head that you're going to somehow or other have sex with somebody? He said, that's what he kind of chuckled. He said, that's what I've never understood. How could you even do that? And so from there, it was kind of a mosaic of talking to different leaders and understanding where you were, who you were fighting, what the threat was. And it was just so different. And that was just an I-Corps.
Well, and then, again, you take a look at the billet you're filling and then the rank. I was over there as a Lance Corporal, you know, McNamara 100,000 plan. So we had the militant blacks.
Easy. Okay, just, guys. First of all, no relation. Everybody needs to know that.
No, it was, I mean, huge difference. I was in with General Rawlins one time on Pella doing a battle study, and afterwards, getting ready to take a boat back up to the main island, and he asked me to sit down and talk to a group of about 30 corporals about my time in Vietnam. And I was sitting there talking to him about all the, you know, the racial problems and stuff we had. And afterwards, he got pissed at me. You know, he didn't do it in front of the troops. He got pissed at me about, you know, making all this stuff up. And I said, you know, sir, you were in Vietnam in 67, and you were a lieutenant, and you were in Force Recon. You know, I was there in 70, 71, as a Lance Corporal and Corporal. I was down in the trenches. I didn't make anything up that I told these guys. And I guess, I don't know if he believed me or not, but, you know, based on his experiences, everything
Carlos
I said was
moved
good.
Up to get him, and the outspoken...
Which it wasn't.
Well, you know, it's amazing in terms of that. I've had people come on, and I won't name them, and say, I never experienced a racial incident in the Marine Corps, and I was in, I joined the Marine Corps in 1957. And I got out in 19.
Yeah, no kidding.
And I got out in 1994.
Oh, you're kidding?
No. And yeah. It's like and you're a bit stunned, but again, so either or you weren't looking for it, or and it said, you know, I know it happened. I just never saw it.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay.
Well, I was right in the middle of it.
I mean,
it was a mess.
Well, no, but the nation was a mess, right?
Yeah.
The nation was a mess. And explain for people that don't know what McNamara's 100,000 was, explain to everybody what that was.
Well, they need to Google it because they're not going to believe what I tell them. You know, during the, you know, Vietnam 67, 68, there was a lot of unrest on campuses because they started drafting college kids. And before that, they weren't drafting college kids. They started drafting college kids, and there was huge problems all over the United States on campus. So McNamara came up with this plan. They called McNamara's 100,000 plan. Google them, you'll see it. But what it was, there's four mental categories that recruiters look for, 1, 2, 3, and 4. You try to recruit 1s and 2s, and you stay away from the 3s and 4s because they're not real smart. So McNamara's plan was come up with a draft, 100,000 categories 3 and 4. And we had the race problems back then, had a lot of drug problems. So they brought 100,000 of these Cat 3s and 4s out and almost ruined the Army, Navy, and the Marine Corps because they pushed these guys into the service. It was a huge problem. And so they brought all the drug problems with them. They brought the Black Panther stuff with them. I mean, it created some huge problems. And I was right in the middle of that, you know, as a Lance Corporal and Corporal.
So how,
you know, Google
so,
that and you'll see what I'm talking
oh,
about.
Oh, no. The interviews I've done are amazing. And I had, you know, Carl Marlanis on. And then what's interesting is now I've developed this group of Vietnam veterans I know. And it's interesting when a subject comes up, then the next time I have them on about a different subject, a lot of it times it's leadership, is to take them back and ask them about racism. And Marlana said, you know, when we were in the bush in Northern I Corps, it was still there, but not so much because your life depended on each other.
In the bush we didn't have a problem.
Right. And
but the problem is when I got to Vietnam,
I went to the field almost right away, and I'm like sitting on the LZ with the helicopter, and I saw a group of black Marines across the LZ, and there was one of those guys that's in my neighbor camp with him. I walked over to say hello to him, and he, you know, pushed me back, met me halfway, wouldn't shake my hand, and said, I can't talk to you because I'll get in trouble with these guys behind me. When we got to the field, that whole group refused to get off the helicopter. Peer pressure and that kind of stuff. He couldn't shake my hand.
Right.
And then they refused to get off the helicopter. And it all went back to peer pressure.
Wow. Wow.
It was a bad time.
Well, you know, but again, if you were there in 68, you know, before a lot of McNamara's.
Completely different.
Yeah, it was completely different. And they're like, yeah, I don't know. That wasn't part of I didn't see that. And but people that were in good units said, you know, we experienced it back in the rear. We listened to different music. We didn't share record players. We didn't go to the same bars. But when we saddled up and we went to the field, you know, most all that stuff was forgotten. And so it's kind of interesting, but people that, as you said, people that were there in 70, that wasn't their experience. That stuff then went to the field with them.
It was pretty bad. Well, right. a lot of the young blacks would go to the field. They'd take the court martial or off, you know, Article 15, you know, court martial, whatever, just refused to go to the field.
Wow.
And that was peer pressure. It wasn't because they were cowards or anything, but they peer pressure from the other blacks.
Wow.
It was a bad situation.
Wow.
A lot of young blacks got in trouble because of peer pressure. They were forced to do things that got them in trouble. I feel bad about that.
Have you read Carl Marlanis's book, Matterhorn?
Yeah, that's a good book.
Well, you know, he said he wrote it and then he had to go back because he didn't feel like he had included the racism that he had seen. He said, you know, I wrote the book and then I thought about it. I thought if this isn't a horizontal theme in the book, then I haven't done it right. And I'll tell you what, even reading it made me uncomfortable that this, a black Marine didn't want to get his hair cut. And you had, I want to say a white gunnery sergeant saying, I'm going to cut your hair. And he was going to have white Marines hold. And you can imagine. He's going to have what? Yeah, you're like, holy shit, you know, somebody's going to get shot. You know, you're going to hold him down and you're going to give him a haircut. And that's
what happened.
Right. And that's related to this issue. And it's not, yeah, that kind of shit, that kind of tension in a unit. Oh, by the way, and you're going to go fight.
And everybody's got weapons. The guy in the rear was dangerous. For us, you were safer out in the field patrolling and ambushing than it was back in the rear. Because everybody had weapons back there.
Yeah, it's
like when I went to Officer Candidate School, my platoon sergeant at Officer Candidate School had been in 3-1. So, you know, we knew each other from Vietnam. We were in the same unit. But he actually got blooper round shot him a couple times in the battalion rear because he was such a hard ass.
And blooper round is?
M79 grenade launcher.
Right, so an M203, but it was much cooler looking. Right, wooden stock.
Yeah, it looked cool. It looked like a shotgun.
You've seen it. You've seen it.
That's a big weapon.
In Apocalypse Now, the dude that comes out of the, I think they're getting high, right? They're getting high in a bunker, and they call his name, and he's a sniper. Or there's a dude across the river yelling at him, and he just listens. And it's a pretty crazy scene. But the weapon that guy has is the M79, for those of you who have seen the movie.
Good weapon.
My guest is Jerry Durant. He is a retired colonel, United States Marine Corps, a veteran of Vietnam, and a whole host of other conflicts. He's now doing contract work in Iraq. And so fun to have him on to hear what's going on there. I had somebody last time you were on send me some questions, so I'm going to ask them to you.
Okay.
Mac, next time Colonel Durant's on, would you ask him, what is the issue that concerns people in Baghdad the most?
Mainly safety for their family. You know, I talked about the high blood pressure. That's what everybody talks about. I said, I've got two doctors on our staff over there, and their number one medical issue was high blood pressure. So people are concerned, you know, about their family. And a lot of the Iraqis I know are trying to get out of the country, and it's just a long, slow process to get a visa.
All right, next question. Could you also ask him about Reconstruction? I thought when I left Iraq the last time, and then he writes in parentheses, in 2006, Fallujah was damaged, but it wasn't that bad. Ramadi was pretty bad, and from everything I've read, it got worse. I even saw video recently, and it didn't look like there was still a building standing in Ramadi. How do they rebuild that part of the nation if they don't have their governance thing settled, or do they?
They don't have it settled, and they're still trying to finance a rebuild. And then Ramadi, you remember the government center downtown, that whole downtown area has been leveled. And it still looks like something from Berlin out of World War II. But they don't have the government settled. You know, the problem is you're out in a Sunni-dominated area, and you've got a Shia-led government. Where's the money going to come from? The Shia's going to pay for it?
No.
The Shia-led Iraqi army does not want to go out and fight and die in Ramadi or Fallujah because it's all Sunnis. So why would they want to go out and die for a Sunni?
Now, there was this is probably a couple of months ago, I read that the Iraqis were in discussions with the Saudis about funding a portion of the reconstruction, but that the Saudis wanted certain guarantees relative to Iranian influence in the country that the Iraqi government couldn't make. And so the Saudis said, okay, look, we'll be happy to cooperate, but we're going to have to sign an agreement that Iraq is not going to be an Iranian-dominated nation or words to that effect. That makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense to you?
Yeah, it does. And I don't think they've come up with an agreement yet because they're still talking about eventually getting money, maybe World Bank or someplace
right.
else to help rebuild the place, but no one wants to put money into it because it's too unstable still.
And then the third piece was, Mac, does Colonel Durant have a path ahead if they were to become a somewhat federalized government in which there were three pieces and there was revenue sharing? Is that being discussed politically? I don't read much of it. So
no, it's not.
Right. So it's being discussed among
the Shias are in charge, and the Shias will do what they want to do.
So
and the Sunnis have been pretty much disenfranchised.
But that is the way that part of the world has been ruled for thousands of years. Yes, is that the strong the strong rules? If you're a minority, you shut up and you color and you don't make a lot of noises, and that's how you survive. And that's simply how that. And if you want to change it, you can rise up, and you can win a war, and then you can be that guy. But until you're that person, you don't have a voice.
That's very true.
So
exactly what's going on?
So, is there any hope that Iraq carves out its kind of owns its own way away from Iran? Because the key to reconstruction, at least the key to Saudi money and Western money, is becoming a stabilized government that resolves the question of the Kurds, that resolves the question of revenue sharing, that resolves the question of Sunni participation, and those are huge questions. So, is there any hope that any of that gets solved in the near future?
My personal opinion, no. It just things are too unstable. The problem with the Shia-led government, you know, they've pushed almost all the Sunnis out of the government, out
right.
of the military. So the Sunnis are disenfranchised. You know, in all Anbar province is what, at 98% Sunni.
Right.
I don't see anything happening in the near future. There's no talk of it in Baghdad.
But they have to resolve it, or else there'll never be peace. I mean,
that's true.
I mean, if the Sunnis, to me, am I going to go get killed in Baghdad if reconstructions going on in Husaba, Al-Qaim, in Ramadi and Fallujah. Money's flowed in there. There's jobs. There's work. Why do I want to go get killed in Baghdad? Because we're not going to win that war. So, I mean, if the Shiites don't solve that, they can't have peace themselves.
That's true.
And this,
like, you know, take a look at what happened in Ramadi. Was about 3 years ago when all the fighting was going on.
Right.
They sent the Iraqi second division out there fighting. They lasted a day and a half. They had to bring the counterterrorism guys up.
Right.
And the reason they lasted a day and a half is because they couldn't fight to begin with. And then, you know, the big thing with the Iraqis was, or the, especially the Shia majority, was why should we fight and die in Al-Anbar province for the Sunnis? We don't like Sunnis. So that's why they brought the counterterrorism force in. Because they're made up of Shias, Sunnis, Kurds, whatever. And same thing up in Mosul, you know, they got the, you know, one of the, where the CTS was fighting the counterterrorism service, and then also the, Shia-led militias were very, very successful. But the Iraqi army, they put them in blocking positions.
The picture you paint isn't a very good one. I don't know if you know that, but are you aware that the picture you're painting is not a good one?
Well, my personal opinion. So, you know, take it or leave it.
Well, no, I mean,
it's the stuff I've been seeing. So.
You've been there for going on 14 years this summer, off and on.
Yeah.
For so you do have a relatively experienced eye relative for events there. It's just it's just interesting. That if you're going to live in peace, if that's your stated goal, then you've got to remedy some of these things. And but clearly, it's not. I don't know. It doesn't seem like in the national government's. It's not on their plate to solve the problem so that you can live in peace. So I don't know how it works, and I'm perplexed that it doesn't seem like there's any progress, Jerry.
No, I haven't seen any progress at all.
Wow. All right.
You know, the Sunnis, I don't know, you know, they're not reaching out to the government. The government's already, like I said before, disenfranchised most of the Sunnis. It's a mess.
All right. First of all, Mike Musselman said to say hey to you.
Ask Musselman next time you talk to him. Ask him about Sniper in downtown Ramadi when we were there.
Which time? You were the human.
No, I was in the government center. He was outside. We were taking a sniper fire, and I came out. And he was all smiles. There were a couple guys on the roof across the government center, and he'd actually bagged one, knocked him off a ladder. The guy flipped over backwards. Ask him about that.
Okay.
Good shooting.
Well, you know what? He prides himself in that.
That was a good day for him.
Had you met him before? You kind of all hooked up in Iraq?
Yeah, he came over with the 5th Marines because right. I needed my own PSD. And he trained a PSD outfit from 5th Marines. He came over. That was the first time we met. And then the guys we had were all the radio operators and radio techs and mechanics. And none of them were grumps. He did a good job training those guys.
He's a bit of a unique player because, first of all, he doesn't know what lane he belongs in, so he weaves in and out of every lane. And there isn't a rule that he's ever encountered that he's not afraid to break if the situation is appropriate. But he's a smart guy and he's a fun guy to have around because he's not a doom and gloom guy. He's a fun guy.
Unlike me, right?
No, you're the same way. Well, I tell the story. You relieved, I think, you came in on the heels of a major who was trying to do work, do something with what they call it, the ANG and the police, the Afghan National.
It was ICDC and then the
right.
ANG, working the police and the borders.
Right.
And
so.
No, that was a huge mess.
It was a mess. And all of a sudden, an adult walks in. And says, all right, let me get my hands around it. And it got better. I mean, it was still a confused mess out there. But it got better, and there was confidence because it's like, hey, Colonel Durant's here. Like, I don't know that guy, but He sounds like he knows what he's talking about. And you did, and you
interesting time.
Oh, without a doubt. And there you crossed paths with Mike Musselman. One final question. The American presence in the region, it's ebbed and flowed. What do the Iraqis say about us, our willingness to stay? Do they need us? Do they not need us? They've seen life both with us and without us. What are their thoughts on the United States?
Well, like I told you, when I first got hired to do this stuff at the Iraqi War College, I got hired to be the senior mentor for Lieutenant General. I lasted maybe 10 minutes in the first meeting. So for the last couple of years, or the first couple of years, it's very hard to deal with anybody in Iraq if you're an American. And it's the tables have turned now. Probably the last maybe year and a half, they want Americans there. They want us to stay. They want people to come in as mentors. They want to work with us because they understand how important the U.S. is.
Really?
And I think General Mattis has made a big difference too. Everybody's very Iraqi's very happy, seeing him come in and set up. He's done a good job, supporting everything.
I I think the whole world loves General Mattis, which is kind of crazy if you know him. But he's a different cat. But no, he goes places. The stuff he says, right? People take to the bank because he doesn't talk out of both sides of his mouth, and he tends to get it right. The kind of advising we're doing now in Afghanistan, is I was listening to Roger Turner. Do you know Roger?
Oh yeah, I know Roger.
Okay, he came back and he did a talk with Brookings, and he was talking about there's a difference between, as an advisor, enabling them, supporting them, and training them, and creating dependence. And we have to advise in such a way that we enable them, and we don't create dependence, because where we create dependence, that's not a good thing. And he said the other thing, if we're going to sustain this for the long term, and here in Afghanistan, what that means is that the long term means the Afghan army is going to win. That's what that means. And the Taliban know that if we stay. And what that means is big Taliban's going to get stripped from little Taliban, domestic Taliban, big Taliban over in Pakistan, and you can get little Taliban to the bargaining table if you stay.
Yeah.
But our center of gravity is we can't have a lot of casualties, and this can't break the bank. And so there's a way to advise in the context of all of that that makes them more effective, limits our own casualties, and has a limited footprint. And what that ultimately does is forces the little Taliban to the table, which means that we someday might get a political settlement, which is what we want. And he said, but you got to do smarter and you got to do better. And so it's very interesting to see, and that was all a Mattis Dunford event. It started the way they did the advising in and around Mosul. Not a lot of American casualties. They were there providing advice, providing supporting arms, but not doing the fighting, and proved to be pretty successful.
Yeah. Well, again, they had the counterterrorism service working with them, and then also the Iranian-led Shia militia. So they had some good fighters.
Right. And one of the things that I heard Roger say was that, there's guys in Afghanistan, they'll fight, but they're not always properly led, they're not always properly supported. When they are properly led, and when they are properly supported, and they'll go on leave, and guess what? They'll come back. Because they believe that if they do get wounded, they're going to get treated. They're going to get taken care of, and they also believe that they'll probably go on leave again because they're winning now. So it was very interesting to hear his thoughts on advising and how what we're doing at the tactical level there ultimately can help us win at the strategic level in terms of a diplomatic settlement. So yeah, keep our fingers crossed. All right, where's the next big adventure? Where are you headed?
Leaving tomorrow morning for Germany. I got a kayak trip coming up.
Kayaking on what river in Germany?
Mosel I'll fly into Frankfurt, take the train to Trier, and then Monday morning, take a bus up river, take the boat down, put it in, and float for 6 days, 7 days, or kayak for 6 or 7 days.
So you kayak for 6 or 7 days, and is there food along the way? Do you get your fishing pole out? Do you fish?
Oh, no, we'll stop at now. You'll stop at little German villages every night for stay in hotels. So, well, a couple of years ago we tried this. We took our camping and stuff. And the first, it was raining. The first night we stopped, a German farmer came down to get off my fields. it's very difficult to camp any place in Germany. We've got campgrounds, but this didn't work out for us. So we decided, well, we better can do this. We need to stay in hotels and that kind of stuff. So we roughing it.
All right, who do you go with?
A group. I'm actually doing some work with a group out of Seattle, Washington. Cascade Designs. They do MSO stoves and thermoset mattresses and that kind of stuff. I'm their military and government advisor.
Wow,
that's who's going.
Well played, well played. All right, sir. I know you're a busy guy today. First of all, I appreciate you taking time out of your day
to talk
to us, and hopefully our paths will cross physically sometime soon. And good luck today.
Yeah, well, that's planned out.
That is retired Marine Corps Colonel Jerry Durant talking about the situation in Iraq and what the future holds. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Arriving at Quezon was a real experience because the plane came in hard and fast, did an immediate U-turn, never stopping, spun a U-turn at the end of the runway, and body bags were being thrown in as you tried to go out the back tailgate. And there were people waving in trenches at the very end, telling you to get over there, get over there, get over there. And you're carrying your duffel bag, and you don't really know what's going on. Why? What's the hurry? Well, then rockets started coming in.
When the ammo dump exploded, man, we thought it was atomic.
Our bunker was right kind of in front of the ammo dump. We was on the garbage pit side. And that first round went in. It was spooky. I didn't know what the hell was happening.
There's an explosion right in the doorway of the hooch. Slammed me against the bulkhead, the walls there. And then I knew shit was hitting the fan here. Scared the crap out of me, of course. I was all discombobulated.
Mayhem, the wounded laying in the trench. Our own artillery rounds that were stored in the ammo dump were cooking off and shooting straight up in the air and coming down on us.
We got rounds coming from the enemy. We got rounds coming from the ammo dump.
And then the CS gas that was blown out of the dump was burning, settling into the trenches because it goes to the low ground and into the bunkers.
I just thought, oh, my God, you're not going to survive this, you know. Little did I know, it was going to go on for 77 days.
Bravo Common, Man Uncommon Valor is the story of Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 26 Marines. It's a documentary film about the 77-day siege of Quezon. It's not a pro-war film nor an anti-war film. It's a story produced by a grunt lance corporal who was there for the entire siege. It's history over the lip of a trench as told by 14 Marines and one Navy corpsman. It's award-winning. It's available on Amazon Prime right now. Watch it. Review it and share it. I say again, watch it, review it, and share it. It has incredible lessons to learn for everybody relative to post-combat related mental health. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.